Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hey, welcome to the Apparatus Architect with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. As we are recording this in the middle of October, some locations our listeners in the East Coast are encountering their first winter storm, which brings to mind the fact that the real snow is not too far behind, and we need to really bring our A-game every day when it comes to operating the apparatus on and about, and any incident scene that, in addition to everything else we face, the road conditions are going to be a little bit more treacherous, and some of the citizens we serve are going to be driving more poorly than they ever have before. So for our listeners, let's keep that in mind here for the next couple of weeks until your area happens to experience what we experience here in Western New York, lovely snow by the middle of October. So today's rundown, we've got Brother Mike's going to take us through three recent incidents briefly of some things, but a myriad of incidents almost from A to Z, and but we're going to be covering a couple of them that were very, very serious in nature. We got a couple of questions from our listeners that we're going to respond to. And our main topic today, somewhat timely given where we are in the state of the economic climate, what can we do, what can you do to reduce the cost of your new apparatus? We're just going to be throwing some things out there that some of them you can initiate immediately. Other things are longer range if you're not planning on buying until early of next year, but some food for thought there. And because Brother Mike and I had such a great time talking last month about things that screw up new apparatus, we are once again going to wrap up by ranting on a couple of other things, and not necessarily things that have upset me, because most of these are ladder truck things we're going to be talking about, but we've got Brother Mike pretty fired up over some things that we just continue to see that we spend a lot of money, and at the end of the day, we scratch our head and wonder, what in God's name did we do? So, opening up, Brother Mike, I know you've got the update on one recent accident and then two other more serious incidents that happened. What do you got for us this month?
Hi, Brother Tom, and to all our listeners. We start out with an update on Phoenix, Arizona, an engine accident that occurred early in October, late in September, actually. As you recall, a responding Phoenix engine company, Engine 910, was involved in a serious crash where, among other things, the captain was very seriously injured after being ejected. And I apologize, the accident actually occurred on August 10th, which happens to be my birthday, but in any event, after a couple-month investigation, here are some of the facts that we now know. The driver of Engine 910 did stop at the red light on the west side of the intersection and cleared all southbound lanes before he proceeded. The driver of Engine 910, however, did not clear all of the northbound lanes of travel before proceeding through that intersection and drove against the light. Just a quick note on that, we have been talking about that kind of situation for years now. You show me a fatal fire truck accident at an intersection, and I will show you something like which occurred here. One of the teaching points here for sure is that we need to treat each lane of an intersection as a complete and distinct intersection all unto itself. What we're finding now is that with the radios blaring, the cars more quiet, the windows rolled up with the heater air conditioning on, that drivers that are four and five and six cars deep at intersections such as these come up upon a line of stop traffic at a green light. They do not see us, they do not hear us, and in an effort to be in a hurry and to make time, they now go on to unoccupied travel lanes, in turn lanes, and in one case, years ago in Staten Island that resulted in a fatal crash in New York City, a woman was actually on the road shoulder. as they're buzzing past the four or five cars in line that were stopped, that did hear us and see us, this driver in this unoccupied lane or travel lane ends up right underneath the truck. In this case, it wasn't quite that severe. It ended up into the side of the truck, but still a lot of property damage, apparatus damage, and, of course, some serious injuries. So you need to treat each separate and distinct intersection, each lane in an intersection, as an intersection all unto itself, and you do not have the right-of-way until you have come to a stop and look left, right, left, and make sure not only that the first car in line of traffic has stopped, but all cars in that line have stopped and do not move. And if it takes an extra 10 or 15 seconds of time to accomplish that, to do it safely, then that's what it takes, and that's what you need to be doing, because as you can see from this particular incident, the end result could be far worse if you don't. Another fact that we now know, that the captain of engine 910 was not wearing her seatbelt at the time of the crash. The civilian driver of the vehicle that struck engine 910 wasn't wearing their seatbelt at the time of the crash as well. No police citations will be issued to the engine 910 driver. However, the civilian driver that struck the engine company is going to be cited for driving with a suspended driver's license and driving without insurance. While there has been much in the way of speculation on this crash, at least those facts that we have just stated are now the facts as we know them. As far as some other lessons to be learned here, really nothing new. You have to be seated and belted in the apparatus before it begins to move. That's right out of the NFPA. You must stop at all controlled intersections, and even if you have the green light, you should at least have your foot covering the brake and prepare for somebody to actually run the light in front of you. Officers must not only set an example, but ensure that their members are following policy, and the officer needs to enforce that policy. If we don't do that, again, firefighters and officers being ejected and wrecked apparatus are going to be the theme of the day. And any comments on that particular apparatus crash, Tom?
Mike, just one thing that strikes me, that Phoenix, Arizona certainly has led the fire service nation with a lot of different innovative operations, their fire ground policies, and certainly from a safety standpoint, from a far West Coast perspective, as I can recall, they were one of the first departments to adopt four-door cab apparatus way before it was mandated by the NFPA. And it was largely done, quite honestly, I don't think, safety was probably one of the thoughts, but it was when they were launching the ability of the engine companies to deliver paramedic service, and the thought was, we need to keep the folks cool and the drugs cool. And so you look at it, over 20 years, the city of Phoenix has been operating a fleet of fully enclosed four-door cab rigs, but still bad stuff can happen to good people if you don't follow common safety guidelines. And, without beating up the incident, that's what comes to mind to me there. You can buy the best, safest, crash-tested, rated fire truck that's made anywhere in America and pay three times as much, but if you're not belted inside the cab, you're just like a loose tool in there, and bad stuff's going to happen. This crash that you're going to talk about in Perry Township, Indiana, Mike, we not only crashed the fire truck, but we catch this bad boy on fire.
Yeah, that's correct. This happened in the state of Indiana. Two firefighters were on their way back from providing mutual aid in this early morning crash, and they crashed the tanker into a tree. Once the tanker hit the tree, evidently the fuel saddle tanks broke open, and the vehicle caught fire. There's some, again, pictures that are out there on each of the websites. The tanker was a total loss, and it was the only tanker that the department owned. And so can now, even with mutual aid, though, can this department provide the same level and quality of fire protection that they could prior to this accident? And, of course, the overwhelming answer is no. If you only have one of something, be it a tanker or a rescue or a squad or a truck company, and you wreck it, well, now you have none. And you are just simply not able to provide the fire protection that you once could. And so when you only have one of something, it makes it even more egregious when it gets wrecked and totaled out. We've talked about it at different points in time. One of the things that we try to speak against is to panic once this happens. Certainly one of the things that the department could do in the interim is either rent or lease a truck or buy a used truck until they get their collective act together and recover, and then can go out. And if there is insurance involved and enough, they could potentially go out and spec out a new apparatus without having to rush into anything and rushing to judgment. The second part of this accident to just highlight as a teaching point is the fact that the vehicle was coming back in the early morning from a mutual aid fund. And sometimes, in fact, a lot of times, when operators go to the scene of fires in the early morning hours, they're awake, the adrenaline's flowing. And if you channel that adrenaline properly, it can actually help you drive the apparatus, as long as you don't allow the adrenaline itself to drive the apparatus. It kind of tends to work in our favor. The problem becomes after, particularly a working mutual aid fire where you may have been out for several hours during the night, and now all of a sudden you're released and you don't have that adrenaline anymore. But all of the same dangerous elements that were present in the response are still present on the way back to the station. Driving, keeping the truck on the road, being responsible for the firefighters inside the truck, and anybody and any property that you're driving past outside the truck. So we need to learn to take the return trip to quarters just as seriously, with just as much attention to detail as we do during the adrenaline-filled response, and feel very strongly about that. On some given years, there are as many, if not more, accidents returning from responses than there are actually responding. And science has proven over time that this is one contributing factor, at least. Your thoughts, Tom?
Well, agree with everything you said, Mike, and then the last, parting thought on this is that you say, yeah, you've got insurance on the vehicle, but a lot of times it depends on how the policy is written. In a lot of cases, departments have found that the insurance adjuster, unlike some of those television ads you see on TV touting certain capabilities of insurance companies, a guy necessarily isn't going to come out the adjuster, take a look at your fire truck and write you a check that day, and you're going to be without the unit for some period of time. You have still the associated actions of the drivers and the impact on folks in the fire department wanting to ride with them, in addition to having to just go through the hassle of having to unexpectedly replace a unit that you hadn't planned on doing. So no matter what happens, whether it's wearing your seatbelt in incident number one, whether it's controlling your consumption of alcohol, and if you choose to imbibe, then stay home and don't show up to work. If you're a career firefighter, don't show up on the run. If you're a volunteer or a call firefighter, stay at home and sleep or work it off, and always have your wits about you, not only responding but returning to the alarm. So this takes us to, first of all, our three questions this month, and this one, Mike, is for you. This is from Scott, and he says, I'm a new driver assigned to Ladder 2, and I'm having trouble with parking the truck in the proper location when it comes to positioning the outriggers. We operate a E1 110-foot rear mount, and the tormentors are located approximately 19 feet apart, and it's rather tough to set it up on the streets downtown and at the north end. any suggestions on how I can best park the ladder? I've seen some units park at angles, but I don't know these benefits. So, Mike, how can we help this gentleman?
A couple thoughts come to mind. First, in most aerial and tower apparatus, we have the ability to short jack the apparatus, which would then reduce that 19-foot jack spread, what we call the operational footprint of the vehicle. And one of the things that we've been doing in ladder classes in the last several months is to actually physically measure the vehicles to see what their operational footprints really are. With some Emergency One units, they do not have the ability to short jack that the all of the jacks, two or four, particularly the underslung kind of jacks, the A-frame jacks that those units have, does not allow you to short jack the unit at all. So in the case of Scott here, because of it doesn't make it good or bad, it just is part of what the apparatus, how the apparatus is built and what it includes. And so it's not necessarily a negative or it's not necessarily a positive. It's just kind of one of those things. It is what it is. So he probably, with this unit, does not have the ability to short jack it. So then he talks about, in his question, about pulling at an angle. And many times, particularly with rear-mounted apparatus, it's best if there is room to work off of the back. Because you get the cab out of the way, you can increase the scrub area most days by quite a bit. And it's really critical if you happen to have, for instance, a mid-mounted tower where you really have to work off what we call the window of opportunity. And that window of opportunity in many newer units is now controlled by cab avoidance or collision avoidance systems, and it depends on the tolerances of that system and how they were set up as to how much scrub area. And, of course, we describe scrub area as that area of the building wall that can be touched by the basket of a tower ladder or aerial tower or the tip of an aerial ladder. By if there were room in this downtown street to back in an alley, that may help him. Or at the very least, if he tilts the cab and angles it away from the building where he's going to operate, particularly if he's going to operate in more of a horizontal rather than a vertical configuration, that may help him as well. But the reality is that with this particular unit, if the operational footprint is 19 feet, then you need at least 19 feet to set the vehicle up. And just looking at this, well, yeah, 3 and 3 and 6, yeah, you may need all of that 19 feet as far as real estate to set the truck up. And if you don't have that, with the inability to short jack it, you may simply not be able to use the vehicles. Putting the outrigger into the car side, which he kind of alluded to here, is not very good. Of course, if you're going to save a life, it depends certainly on the fire and the situation. I mean, you have to do what you have to do, but generally putting the outrigger on objects such as cars and trucks and sewer covers are not really beneficial and would probably not be all that stable. So that's not necessarily a great idea either. But, again, if somebody's hanging out a window and you show up and you don't have the 19 feet, that may be something that you have to consider. One thing that you could do is to take a 6-foot pike pole or hook, and you can use that before you engage the PTO and deploy your outriggers. You can use it to judge where those outriggers are going to be. And there may be a situation on the street where you could actually deploy the outriggers in between two parked cars rather than going into the side of one and still be able to operate the vehicle fairly efficiently and get where you need to get the tip of the ladder.
Well, Mike, that takes us for the our ladder truck question of the month. I understand you got one in the bullpen for me, and it's something to do with engines. So what do you got on that?
Okay, I have a question from Ed, and Ed is talking about pumps, which is right up your alley. Mike and Tom, do you have any information or documentation on the pros and cons of a two-stage pump versus a single-stage pump? And also, if you had a choice, which would you prefer over the other and why? And we get this question quite a lot, and so this is a good question for you to tackle, Brother Tom.
Well, it's a couple things. First, from a historical standpoint, two-stage pumps going back in the in fire service apparatus history, at least, were somewhat the norm during the era where gasoline engines, and then in later years in the 60s into the 70s, nominal horsepower output diesel engines were prominent, because it was very difficult to have a power plant that could run the pump efficiently through its entire operation of the span on a standard pump curve for a Class A pump. As diesel engines became more predominant, two-stage pumps fell somewhat out of favor. In a large case, I think, because of people's perceived simplicity of operation. It eliminated the transfer valves, the external transfer valve on the fire pump, the internal clapper valves that separated each of the impellers, the one stage from the other. And I think it was the beginning for the newer generation of fire service people, for chauffeurs or engineers, that it just became a point of, you know, you dial up, you know, the pressure that you need on the compound gauge, and you're done with it. For a good number of years in large cities, two-stage pumps at one point were the standard, and in a lot of cases still are, because of the ability of a two-stage pump to deliver higher pump pressures. We're generally talking pressures in excess of 200 PSI now, at lower engine RPM, which, again, in the day of the gasoline engine was very valuable. In the day of the what's now, you know, standard throughout everything we use, the diesel engine is potentially of less importance, other than the fact that higher engine speed, you are getting increased engine wear, you're getting increased pump wear because you're running the pump through the transfer case at a higher speed. And from a fuel economy standpoint, well, there in the past, it's different here given the current economic conditions and climate, that you certainly have fuel efficiencies in terms of the amount of fuel consumed per hour when you're pumping for extended periods of time. There is somewhat of an economic impact that the two-stage pump, because it has more internal and external pieces, it does cost a little bit more initial purchase price over a single-stage pump. And I think more of it, Mike, was based on the history of the department itself. There's a lot of departments that just, for whatever reason, migrated away from two-stage pumps and then have been single-stage pumps forever, never looked back. The two-stage pump, again, does have significant advantages when you're pumping higher pressures, certainly if you're doing any extensive amount of high-rise work or pumping standpipes, that the two-stage pump has some advantages, again, as we had mentioned, over the single-stage pumps. If anything, you know, single-stage pumps are, there's more of those built and produced each year than there are two-stage pumps, so it's like any other choice that we have in the fire service. If you see what the majority of consumers, being fire departments, are buying, the tendency is, if you're in a smaller organization, you look up to the bigger brother down the street or across the block or in the next county, and you see what they're doing and say, geez, if that works for them, that probably should work for us. But again, a number of years, you know, the city of New York continues to do two-stage pumps together with other larger cities where they do a lot of heavy pumping and do a lot of work with their pumping standpipes. And another reason you see a little bit more emphasis of people of using single-stage pumps is for the physical size of it. With the advent of rear-mount pumps, or now like with the design that Pierce has with the Puck, that is a very compact pedestal-type pump, and those pumps, by their very nature, are single-stage in design. So if you're buying a vehicle like that, you don't even have a choice of single-stage versus two-stage. So it's like taking that option off the plate. I guess the last one of Ed's questions, which was very well put, if it were my choice, it's as if anybody's ever seen Mike and Tom, Tom's a little old school, I'd kind of prefer to have the two-stage pump to have the flexibility. That's what I was brought up and trained on, and I know how to run them. If you looked at a lot of departments, and this has been the case when Mike and I have gone out to do training, if they have a unit, no matter what the vintage is, and they have a two-stage pump, and you ask them, what stage do you keep the pump in? A lot of cases, you get a blank stare. They're not even sure what you're asking. And then if they do say, well, we keep it in parallel, and you say, okay, well, when do you switch over? They'll look at you and like, geez, never been asked that question. So it's one of those things that it's, unfortunately, it's almost become a dinosaur in the fire service if your department has not had access or ever trained or operated with a two-stage fire pump. It's got a lot of function and capabilities, but people have tended to migrate away from them. If you think about the modern-day fire truck, to wrap up, you can put the transmission in neutral upon arriving at the scene of the incident, set the maxi brake, engage the road, the pump shift, or whatever the mechanism is to put the fire pump from the road position to the pump position, drop the transmission into the drive gear, go out, set your wheel chocks, pull your tank to pump line, and in a lot of departments, it's then pull one valve and hit a button because they've got a preset on the pump governor, and that's about all the pump operator does anymore. And again, part of it, I think if you get into more sophisticated hydraulics, pumping multiple lines, doing tandem pumping, a whole bunch of things that are very common in certain areas, but if they haven't been taught or part of the training program for your MPOs or your chauffeurs, they look at it as that the old adage of simpler seems to be better, and for that reason, two-stage pumps, over the period of years, you see fewer and fewer of them. They're still made, still very good, and still have a application, in the fire service. Just best parallel to wrap up on that one, Mike, it's kind of like having mud and snow tires versus highway tires. If you're in a jurisdiction and it never rains and it never snows and you don't ever take the rig off the road, a highway tire will do just fine for you. But a highway tread is not going to work if you're up in the Northeast and you need to travel in conditions that are going to be less than optimal. So it's one of those things. It's one of those choices out there, and you have to carefully assess what your operations are, get good advice if you can, and then make a good decision. So understand we got one more question.
Yep, Tom, this is for you. This question comes from Steve. And he is a major of rank, and he writes, there's been significant discussion about the approval or NFPA-compliant wheel chocks that fire apparatus should deploy once they are parked on the fire ground. Most places incorporate the use of wheel chocks as a requirement once the maxi brake is set and firefighters dismount the apparatus. There are several different types of wheel chocks utilized, and I am having trouble finding a standard that is required to determine the approved type, if there is such a thing. Several questions come to mind as to what standard is used to determine compliance, and is it a construction standard or a performance standard? And does the standard actually come from the NFPA, or is it from SAE or OSHA or some other regulatory body? I know this seems like an odd request for your assistance, but there is an ongoing debate over this issue. Can you point me in the right direction? I would be extremely grateful. Steve.
Well, Mike, there's a couple of questions embedded in Steve's thing, but a very good question, and again, one that's kind of often asked, and it is good to me that people are getting the question, because that means that they're using the chocks, or at least have a policy in place where they're trying to encourage the use of chocks. And it's like the safety vests If you're operating with SCBAs that don't have an integrated pass alarm and it's still an external pass alarm, or it's all these other things that we have that are safety-related devices that sometimes we just stare at and look at and go, you know, that's nice and I might use it today, but then again, I might not. So we appreciate the question from Steve. So to take it one step at a time, the NFPA standard in the current edition of 1901, it references wheel chocks several times under each type of apparatus, but under the pumper portion of the standard, if you have a current copy of the 1901 standard, it appears on page 23, but it says in part, two or more wheel chocks mounted in a readily accessible location that together will hold the apparatus when loaded to its gross vehicle weight rating on a hard surface. So we're talking about a roadway, macadam, concrete, something like that, not on gravel, not on loose pavement, with a 20% grade with the transmission in neutral and the parking brake released. So let's just go through that. So that part is saying they're not telling you what the wheel chock's got to be made out of. You can make it out of Jell-O if you wanted to, but it has to be able to hold your vehicle when it's loaded, in other words, in service, loaded with a full complement of hose, equipment, you know, ladders, whatever it happens to be. And you put this unit on a 20% grade. The transmission is in neutral, so you don't have the unit and the drivetrain holding it back, all right? And the parking brake is released. So in other words, will it hold the vehicle when it's fully loaded on that grade, and will the wheel chock itself, without benefit of any other mechanical device, hold the unit and prevent it from going down the street? So that, they're just saying, again, you got to carry two or more, you have to be in a readily accessible location, and it has to meet that performance criteria. So there are, at least to my knowledge, Mike, and there may be more, there's at least four or five different manufacturers of wheel chocks that offer wheel chocks to the fire service. They may physically look different. Some of them are made out of metal. Some of them are made out of plastic. Some of them are made out of rubber. They may have physically different looking appearances, but they have to be able to meet that performance standard. And then later on, if you go, there is a standard developed by the Society of Automotive Engineers, and that's SAE standard J as in John 348, SAE J 348. That standard is a standard that describes, again, from a performance standpoint, what the wheel chock has to accomplish on tires of certain diameters. So the one thing, if you have a wheel chock and you're curious, I would say this, before you go out and start testing the vehicle, because not every community is going to have a 20% grade, and you want to be doing this in a very safe location. You don't want to be doing this, for example, at the top of a grade with an elementary school, you know, down at the bottom, and see if the apparatus is going to work. First thing you want to do, my two suggestions: one, check out the brake brand, make and model of the wheel chock you have. Contact the people that you either bought the chock from or that manufacture the chock. You can go directly to those folks and find out if they have can provide written certification for you that chock meets the SAE standard, and has it been additionally tested by an independent, you know, third party that it is in compliance with the NFPA standard. If they can supply that data for you, then there's no reason for you to go out to go, quote, test the wheel chock. I can tell you from personal experience in the past, with my experience in the apparatus industry, where the NFPA has a standard that says that the vehicle has to be able to, the parking brake itself has to be able to hold the vehicle on a certain percent grade, that there are some vehicles, when they're loaded to their full capacity, may not meet that standard, all right, and that's something you probably want to have to be checked into. But it's more important to make sure that you use the wheel chocks. And again, you may have, if you've got a large fleet, you may have five or six different physical appearance, different looking wheel chocks, you know, out there. You might want to check into those and see if from whom you bought them. And I would say this, going back, right? If you have, quote, an old style wheel chock that it looks about like the size of a Wheaties cereal box, all right, that may have held a unit in the day that had the old 1020 bias ply tires, that was a tube type tire. It may have held a vehicle like that back in the day when the unit, you know, weighed 30 or 32,000 pounds. If you're running around in a rescue pumper that's got the 425 tires on the front and 12R 22.5 tires on 9-inch rims on the back, and your gross and your GVWR is like is 52 or 53,000 pounds, and you're trying to hold it with the wheel chock that you bought in 1970, I'd be in a, not being a betting man, but I'd be guessing that that wheel chock is not going to meet the standard, and you're going to need to look at upgrading, excuse me, to a chock that's going to work. But that is something, great question from Steve, and, you know, is there anything else that we can do to respond back to that? Or for our listeners, that if they have any questions that they would like Mike and Tom to answer while we're on the air, please send them to podcast@firehouse.com. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into our main topic of the day, what you can do to reduce the cost of your new apparatus. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects on firehouse.com.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
All right, welcome back to this month's segment in October, the Apparatus Architect with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. And our major point of discussion this month, what can you do to reduce the cost of your apparatus? As we all know, the apparatus industry, because of the economy, is way off, some 35 to 40%. Prices for a lot of the components have somewhat skyrocketed because of the impact of inflation, last year's impact of the high material costs, and while things have settled down a little bit, we're now almost at the end of the road of having the availability of the 2007 version emission engines, and we're on the precipice of going into 2010, and that's going to increase the cost even more. So here's a couple of thoughts. First one, and they didn't put me into the space shuttle to figure this one out, but the obvious one, if you have the ability to buy now, to purchase between now and the end of the fall season before the manufacturer that you might be favoring or talking to runs out of their allocation of 2007 engines, if there's any possibility for you to pull that off no matter what, even if it means you're going to sidestep a few of the normal things that you would have encountered, particularly including going through the bureaucratic process of bidding, you want to try to do that. It certainly is becoming more crystallized that the 2010 engines are going to add significant cost, as we've talked about in the past, to the baseline cost of any unit produced with a 2010 engine. And while we're going to be able to breathe cleaner air coming out of the exhaust of that, it's going to do absolutely nothing for us in terms of fire service performance, other than the fact to take up a heck of a lot more real estate on the right side of the vehicle between the diesel particulate filter and the SCR device, depending upon where your manufacturer has decided to locate that, and is going to add significant cost. By significant, we're talking $20,000 and north on a medium or big block engine, with the big block engines costing more. So if you have the ability to fast-track your process, purchase the unit with today's cost with a 2007 engine, that's item one. Item two, where most of us in the past, and Mike and I have preached for quite a bit, about going through the process and some of the early writings that we did in the Apparatus Architect series of how to form the committee, how to develop the specs, interview manufacturers, go look at rigs, and all of that. Well, let's assume that you've got, for the moment, you've got some of that homework done. Rather than sit down and labor through 100 or 110 pages of specifications from each manufacturer, another thought would be, which could assist you in fast-tracking your process, was to develop a bullet list performance spec in lieu of using the manufacturer spec from the salesperson. And a couple of examples. The average pumper specification that you're going to get from any manufacturer, and certainly no disrespect to them, it's going to be somewhere between 80 to 100 pages of written technical verbiage. Well, if you, for example, are looking to buy a Cummins ISL 425 horsepower rated engine, that engine is the same no matter what manufacturer you get it from, yet that's going to take up a couple pages within the specification to detail all the features and the compression ratio and the physical size and the weight of the unit and its displacement and all of that. Secondly, you could look at it in a cab. If your department is interested in buying a flat roof cab with seating for six, with five of them being SCBA seats and you have a particular brand of seat and SCBA bracket that you're looking to do, you can distill that down to a bullet point. Aluminum, 140-inch long cab, flat roof, seating for six. Here's the brand of seat we want. And rather than to have a three-quarters of a page of description for every seat in the cab, you can take that 110 or 100 pages of specs and get it distilled down to 8 to 15 pages of things that are important. If you have a particular light bar, don't say, I want an LED light bar, because there's a bazillion different LED light bars out there. And do you want something that's a basic NFPA compliant bar? Or are you looking for something that has additional modules? Are you looking for a full width 88-inch wide light bar in standard in lieu of a 72-inch bar? So be specific where you need to be specific. But if you have chosen a particular brand of fire pump, you don't need to look at going through the 8 to 10 pages of basic description of the pump. You can say it's this brand, this model, this GPM rating. Here are the suction inlets I want, the discharge arrangement that I want. Here's the piping. Here's the kind of valves. And you can distill that down to about 8 to 10 bullet points. Save yourself a lot of time with the thought that you're then going to take that bullet list and then utilize that as your point of negotiation with the manufacturers. Which brings us to concept number three. This might not apply to everyone, and it might not be legal in some locations, but there are a fair number of communities that you can either bypass the bidding process, or if you're in a department where you take limited tax money, or in some cases maybe no tax funds whatsoever, you might not legally be obligated to go out and actually develop bid specifications and go out and have a public bid opening. You could identify, after analyzing, as we've talked about in the past, the field of players out there and distill it down to two, certainly no more than three, manufacturers that could produce an acceptable piece of apparatus for you. Work through the bullet list, have those people respond back in their specification format how they would address that, and simply negotiate your best price. I think the parallel there might be it's like buying a car. If you're in the market for a certain physical size of car, call it a smaller SUV, your kids are grown up, so now you're only trucking around like I am. You're going to your son's college lacrosse games, and you don't need to have, you know, seating for eight because you're beyond the soccer mom era, and you're just looking for something that's got, you know, reasonable carrying cargo capacity. If you live where Mike and I live, four-wheel drive might be a plus with that kind of vehicle, and you're looking for something with reasonable gas mileage. You distill that down after evaluating what? Consumer reports, reading, going online, looking at some comments that other people have done, and you might get down to two different, you know, manufacturers, makes and models of that small SUV, and what do? You compare and contrast the features and benefits of each, and then most importantly, you negotiate your best price with the two car dealers, and you make a decision. We're kind of taking that same concept where you can down to apparatus. And why are we doing that? It's simply because it's two things, ladies and gentlemen. It's time and money. The more time you spend in the process right now, while 2007 engines are available, the lesser opportunity you might have to secure one of those through a manufacturer. And the second thing, it's price and money. Once they go away, as I think Yogi Berra just, you know, said, it's deja vu all over again. We are going to witness in 2010, I fear, unfortunately, and I think Brother Mike agrees, we're going to look at having the same type of momentary downturn, additional downturn in the economy from a fire truck perspective, in that in 2005 and 2006, a lot of fire departments, when times were better and the funds were available, they purchased units in anticipation of not wanting to purchase a 2007 EPA engine. Now, that's the only thing that's out there, and once that goes away, we're facing the additional technologies, additional cost, and the additional component space that the engine and the emissions package takes up, that to a point takes a little bit away from what we're going to be able to do on the fire truck. So anything we can do to fast track those things would possibly help your department to get a unit sooner rather than later. That brings us to another concept, and this we could, this applies whether you're going to buy now, buy later, buy any time. And the first one of these is, I think you need to evaluate some of the components on your apparatus that are high cost. Well, what are some of those things? You know, if you distill and look at the typical, Mike, and I know this is going to pain you, but we're going to stay with an engine for a while because it kind of, everybody's got one in. Hopefully they can understand this. The most significant cost components that you can put on a fire truck is the impact of the cost of the engine, the transmission, the fire pump, and then it's some of the things that go along with the fire pump, the number of intakes and suction discharges that you have. And they eat up a lot of real estate on the rig, and they cost a lot. So one of the things you want to think about of evaluating, and Mike and Tom, we can counsel you on this. We'll help you out if you want to, send an inquiry into the website. You can call us. You can call us, and we can come out and do some work for you to help you through the process. But these are things you need, some very hard questions, but you need to look at and answer and analyze on your own. First one is the engine, make, model, and horsepower rating. In the past, we had three choices of engines. Now, in the future, you're going to have a choice of one. In some cases, with manufacturers, maybe two different models, manufacturers of engines. But the big thing is going to be, and it's a gut check, do you really need to have that 500, 515, 525 horsepower rated big block engine? In some cases, it might be, I absolutely need it because of my terrain. I need that horsepower. More importantly, I need to spend the money for the torque, right? Because that's what's pushing me up over the hills in my response area. But the cost difference between the big block engine and a medium block being an engine that's got a displacement, roughly somewhere between 350 to 425 horsepower currently is about the breakover point. And anything that has a horsepower rating and a greater than 425 and a torque rating greater than 1,250 foot-pounds of torque generally throws you into the era where you've got a big block engine. In that case, those two items, the change between the engine and having to go from, if you're in the world, obviously, of an Allison automatic transmission, of going from the 3000 series transmission to the 4000 series transmission, those two items combined alone can be anywhere between $8,000 to $12,000 difference between there. And if somebody was looking at a fire truck and you had a price point that you had to hit, and they called Mike Wilbur and said, Mike, we got big problems. We bid this truck, and I'm over budget by $18,000, and I got to do something to get $18,000 of cost out of this. You're not going to get 18 grand out by going from aluminum wheels to steel wheels. You're not going to get $18,000 out of it by changing from a 1,500 GPM pump to a 1,250 GPM pump. But you can get considerable amount of that money out of there by looking at, if you spec the big block engine, you have to say, am I buying this because I really need it? Or am I buying it because I want it, and historically that's what I've got? So that's one thing you want to look at. The second thing we kind of alluded to was the fire pump rating. Most fire departments, at least those in the East Coast, a lot of the ones that Mike and I have worked with, right, if you go back 20 years ago, the highest rating fire pump you had in the station was probably 1,000 or maybe 1,250. Now if you had a 1,250 pump, when that rig went to get replaced, you typically replaced it with a 1,500 GPM pump. Then you maybe replace that with a 1,750 or a 2,000 or maybe even a 2,250. And in the past, when times were better, because people said, hey, if there's not that much cost difference in the fire pump, and plus, I've got a 500 horsepower engine, so it'll power the fire pump anyway, we're just like, hey, why not? You know, we've already crossed the threshold into the big block motor, so let's just go put the biggest pump on there that seems reasonable that we can afford. Well, now those two things interplay with one another. If you're buying that 400 to 425 horsepower motor, that may not power, depending upon the pump and the application, that may not actually power a 1750 or 2000 GPM pump. It very well might. But don't get caught up into the fact you say, well, you know, we're buying big horsepower, big fire pump. Why? Because we can. those two things, again, are intimately interrelated, and there's some cost there, because if you can do your job and you start analyzing the number of fires you've been to, understanding that the pumps obviously are rated at draft, you can take a 1,250 GPM pump, and if it's fed by enough adequate water sources under a positive head, that pump will do 1,750, probably do close to 2,000 gallons per minute on a fire ground, all right? So do you really need to get the pump rating because of what? ISO? If your community is only running two or three engines, that you might have a valid case there. If you're running a good-sized fleet of apparatus, when ISO comes to town, your basic fire flow maxes out at 3,500, and after that, buildings go on an individual portion of the schedule. So, you know, if you had a fleet of seven 2,000 GPM pumps, you're buying that, I'm suspecting, because you can, not because you really need them. The third concept is looking at the number of pump discharges. And this is not to talk you out of, you know, a number of discharges to do the job that the engine company needs to do. Mike and I, when we go out and do our engine and truck class, we talk about the big five, minimum five pre-connected attack lines of different sizes and lengths. So that means you got to have at least five discharges somewhere, all right? Plus, you need to have a discharge and supply a large LDH discharge. You need to have a discharge to supply, if you're going to have it, a top-mounted deck gun, master stream, appliance, wagon pipe, all right? So you're not going to be able to eliminate discharges, but you see a number of apparatus out there that have two discharges on the left side panel and three on the right and a couple on the rear that maybe not be used, and you start totaling everything up and you've got a 1,500 GPM pump, and we've seen them, and I'm sure some of our listeners have as well, and it's got 12 to 14 discharges. Well, those things didn't come for free, ladies and gentlemen, all right? So start looking at, do you really need to have the number of discharges, and particularly if you're going to be having electronic controls for them or deciding you want to have flow meters on everything. All these things come. They're nice. They're bells and whistles. They were maybe nice when we could afford it, but if you're down to the point where you've convinced your community you need a new fire truck, all right, it might be very difficult given today's economic times to then go back and say, oh, by the way, I need $550,000 to go buy a pumper, when the last one you bought maybe cost well under $400,000, and your city administrator, the comptroller, whomever controls the purse strings, is going to look at you and like, you need what? All right. In a lot of communities, it's caused the fire department to more carefully have to justify more than ever why they want, you know, why they need what they've developed in their specifications, and then be able to go secure the funds for that. And again, please understand, Mike and Tom, we don't have a problem with high horsepower pumps. If your community needs a 2,000 GPM pump, I've seen rigs down in the Pennsylvania area that have 8 or 10 pre-connected lines of different lengths. That stuff's great, and I'll drive 400 miles to go look at it. But if you're in a tight budget situation, and the thing is you really need the fire truck, but you may or may not need all of the stuff that you've in the past been accustomed to buying, you might want to carefully think that before you go through. And the last one is look at the need for high-output generators, light towers, foam systems. Those three components will individually, really, really nice, very beneficial, right? But in the day back years ago, an engine company may have had a 2,500 or a 3,000-watt generator, a couple of light, small cable reel, and it was enough basically to power a 16-inch fan, and that was it. If your department already has an engine company, in addition to your rescue or whatever your other support units are, that have large generators and light towers, if you take the cost differential between a pumper that still might have a brow light, side-facing lights, and have telescopic lights, but they're 12-volt powered, or a combination of 12-volt with the new LED technology, and compare and contrast that to a unit that has, for example, a 15 kW generator with a light tower mounted on a roof, those things are nice, but that generator light tower package, depending on size, make, and model, you're between, certainly, in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $30,000 to put those two items on there. If you absolutely need it and you're in a small department and you don't have that capability, it makes all the sense in the world to put it on there. But again, if you're running in a station and you open up your bay doors and you've got, you know, three stations and every engine that shows up has got a 15K generator and a light tower, I'm just saying, based on today's economy, might be time for a sanity check, all right? If you absolutely have to have them, not a problem. But those things together with large capacity foam systems are all high dollar, high cost items to take the cost of that, what used to be around the $380,000 to $400,000 fire truck, and you put those things on together with a bunch, say I need to have flow meters on everything, I need to have electronic valves because I don't want to have any pull rods on anything, and pretty soon you're throwing around money at $10,000 to $12,000 a crack, and you just run the cost of the vehicle up by $60,000 to $70,000. You then get the price back from the guy, even if he negotiated the best price, and he tells you, Chief Wilbur, that pumper, not a problem. We can do it. We built a lot of them, and it's going to be $525,000. And you know in your heart there's no way that the community's going to spend $500,000 for a fire truck. You got a problem. And, again, you're not going to get that cost down by, changing tires, changing rims, going from an 88-inch wide full-width light bar to a 72-inch bar. That ain't going to save you $12,000. So, and lastly, you may want to evaluate the need versus the cost to look at buying a program pumper. We're not talking entry level here, folks. Back a couple of issues ago in Firehouse, Mike and Tom wrote up an article on a program pumper that was down in Winchester, Virginia, that was extremely well designed, all right, but was designed because the department at that particular station couldn't go out and go for a full-blown, start with a blank piece of paper, scratch-built custom pumper. All of the major manufacturers now, and again, we are not talking demo units, something that they built up in anticipation that somebody's going to buy it, like looking at a car on a lot. We're talking about a unit that would be built to meet your needs, but things where there are defined options and a combination of options that have already been pre-engineered and worked. And those program pumpers, in a lot of cases, can meet your needs, can do a great job without you having to look at, having to face the fact to say, if I don't have $450,000 to $500,000, I've got nothing to go on. So there are some thoughts on what you can do to reduce the cost of your apparatus. Now, I know Brother Mike has been silent here for the last couple of minutes, and I know he's just ready to rail into this. Mike, I know you got a couple of things that you want to talk about additionally that we were discussing last month of things that screw up new apparatus. So what have you got that you want to throw out in part to the listeners today?
Thanks, Brother Tom. First, would like to discuss raised roof cabs, 10-man raised roof cabs, 8-man raised roof cabs. Generally, with very few exceptions, I go around and teach emergency vehicle operations, and I will ask the class, why do you put a raised roof cab on a fire truck? And the overwhelming response is so that you can stand up and get dressed. The NFPA is very clear on this, and it is written as part of the standard that the driver, not the officer, not the fire chief, not the guys in the back, but the driver cannot put the apparatus in any gear whatsoever until everybody on board the apparatus is completely dressed and seated and belted, period. And so this is in direct conflict with the standard. And, of course, there are some departments and perhaps even many that kind of poo-poo the standards and ignore them as if they didn't exist. One would only have to go back to September 15th, 2001, 4 days after the World Trade Center collapsed, and it was an incident that probably because of the World Trade Center calamity and the Pentagon and Shanksville and just the times in general, this was probably not covered nearly what it would have been had those events not occurred, and that is the death and injury of firefighters in Lairdsville, New York, where a training fire was set, and the assistant fire chief was tried criminally and convicted, and in part his conviction was based on not following the NFPA live burn standard. And so it just seems to me that that was a tremendous court precedent that was set at the time, and that if you stand up in a fire truck and start to get dressed in one of these raised roof cab configurations and you fall out, it wouldn't seem to be a stretch to me that if some aggressive assistant DA that wants to make a name for him or herself wants to prosecute the driver, given the standard and given the fact that it was already used to put one of us in jail, that very well could be the case, that we could actually have one of our operators jailed based on the standards. So I think the days of taking the standards and looking away or ignoring them or just poo-pooing them are certainly gone for good. There are only a couple of exceptions that I've seen where raised roof cabs were not used for standing up and getting dressed, and that is in some kind of rehab situation where they're using the cab to get warm or get cool, or in the case of paramedic engines where over that particular part of the cab's raised roof, they actually have room for compartments and for a gurney. But again, that compartmentation there, along with holding the gurney, is generally made for medics to stand up. And most of those are not secured within the vehicle. And so for years, I have always thought that that was screwed up and that the NFPA should really outlaw raised roof cabs. Now, there are some firefighters, although they be very few, that are extremely tall that may not necessarily fit in a conventional cab that's a flat roof, but certainly those folks are few and far between. And then as we developed the aerial class and started going around and seeing what raised roof cabs do, particularly to rear-mounted aerial towers, I know, having consulted for several of the major manufacturers on building new trucks, it became apparent that when you raise a roof, at least on this one particular brand, that if you have a raised roof cab and you are going to operate the tower basket out off the front of the vehicle, that you can only get down to 17 degrees. However, if you left the roof flat, you could get down to 11 degrees, which is a 6-degree difference. And just talking on the show here, it doesn't sound like much until you put that aerial tower out at 80 or 90 feet, and then you find out that 6 degrees of difference off the front of the vehicle can make the difference of hitting, you know, at some point maybe 10 or 15 more windows than you could have hit had you raised the cab roof. So just not a big proponent. It's in most cases they're just used to stand up and just makes the firefighting that's already dangerous just inherently more dangerous by allowing that to occur. The last thing that really screws apparatus up, and we continue on with the cab, is just the amount of equipment all of a sudden that's starting to be mounted inside the cab enclosure with the firefighters. I guess the only motivation would be to save time, or perhaps if there wasn't room elsewhere on the truck. But most of the apparatus that I've seen, there's substantial room outside the truck, and so one would have to think that it was meant to put equipment here as some kind of time-saving device or some kind of time-saving endeavor that the individual departments make them lead to this kind of behavior of securing all this equipment. And I mean a sizable amount of equipment. And although they're in 9G brackets, like Brother Tom and I both have written about extensively, and we need to follow that. As far as time, we talk about time, and having been both on the volunteer and the career side for a number of years, I can't remember one fire that I've ever been to where a minute or even two has really made a significant difference. Generally going to fatal fires, by the time we showed up, the people were probably dead before we ever got called. And, you know, or the people that were in danger, we could rescue and aid. We get wrapped up in this time thing where everything has to be fast and quick, and we have to have equipment right at the ready. And that's just not – that's nonsense, and it's just simply not true. The facts don't prove that out. To take a 20- or 30-year truck and take half your complement of tools and mount it inside the cab under the guise of wanting to save a couple seconds just makes no sense whatsoever. Any thoughts on those three things that I think screw up apparatus, Brother Tom?
Well, Mike, I think you made some you made some good points to the point of you know, 8-person or 10-person raised roof cabs. Completely agree. I think it's if the economic conditions of our country now don't cause us in the fire service to do a reality check to look at, you know, what's our staffing levels, what's our average staffing levels, and that's one thing to say, okay, we're looking to ride out with 4, and there may be times we have 6, perfectly understandable. I have sat down in meetings and had people tell me, both with Mike and I doing work, as well as previously in my earlier license as a representative for an apparatus builder, and have people with a straight face tell me, we need to have seats for 10 on here because of the parades are on meeting nights. And I guess I'd have to say, you know, you didn't buy your personal car and the family truckster, you know, based on the number of times where your kids might have a birthday party that you're then responsible for bringing all the little kidlets home at the end of the event. You didn't buy, you know, a 16-passenger minivan for those times. We don't buy a 10-person, you know, seating fire truck for the times when we have a meeting or for the parade season. If that's the way you're buying apparatus, you need more help maybe than Mike and I can help you with. Secondarily, on the raised roof part, why do we do that? Candidly, because we can. You know, before raised roofs became available in the early to mid 1980s, when a couple of manufacturers started to develop and build four-door cabs well in anticipation of what the NFPA standard was going to be. If you think about it, for those of us who have been around for a while, somehow for the preceding however many years, we figured out how to operate without raised roof cabs. Cabs became enclosed in four-door versions, and we fully understand that not everybody is going to be able to stand up in them. You have to think about now from a safety perspective, they really shouldn't be designed so you can stand up in them. If the unit is a hazmat unit or a command unit or some type of rescue dive unit, that's a different subject. We're talking about the everyday Class A pumper running up and down a road, the everyday rear mount aerial device, all right, that you really need to have a raised roof in that for the sake of what? What are you doing that really mandates that you have to have a raised roof? And to finish up, Mike, on the mounting of the stuff inside the cab, I'll admit I'm guilty on some units that I've designed in the parts I've been with. Yeah, we put a pair of irons in there and possibly a rabbit tool and stuff so you could come out of the cab with the basic tools that work. But we've now seen people take it to an extreme because of the excellent job that manufacturers and component suppliers have done out there. People like Performance Advantage, folks like Sensible Products and Zyco that have different brackets available. Because these brackets are now available and we have room on the back wall, we somehow need to look at this. It's like moving into converting a bedroom that used to be a bedroom into an office, and you say, wow, look at that, I got some wall space, I better buy something because I need to hang it on a wall, otherwise I'm looking at a blank wall. We've gone to an extreme that Mike and I have seen people that are mounting extinguishers inside the cabs, that are mounting 8-pound malls and lock breakers and stuff that, you know, the inside of the cab that's our safety zone was not designed to look like Bob's True Value Hardware Store in the hand tool section. If there's stuff you absolutely need to operate with, all right, keep that stuff down to a minimum, or decide with the design in either the cab or the body a compartment that's completely enclosed that's going to do the same thing for you and potentially do it more safely than if somebody doesn't put the thing in the correct bracket. Or as we've seen, worse yet, we've seen rigs that had stuff mounted in the cab. Half of them are mounted in brackets that are 9G brackets that are approved. And then you look at a pair of bolt cutters and somebody put them in a pair of tulip clips and a pocket. That is not going to hold that thing if the rig goes over. So, Mike, again, some great stuff. For our listeners, might not agree with everything that we see, but that we say out there. But a lot of the stuff, what we see, people went down the road of having, one person wisely said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We started out on the right foot. We got sage advice. We did what we thought was going to be the smart stuff. And then you go back and look at it and say, what the heck's going on? The wheels came off the bus, or the best expression I've heard recently is he's out there where the bus doesn't run. That's a good one line. So, Mike, we want to end up with on a somewhat sad and somber note, some news you want to relate to our listeners?
Yeah. Tom, it's we are deeply saddened, both Brother Tom and I, to report the passing of Pete Jorgensen. He was the publisher and editor of Fire Apparatus and Equipment Magazine, one of those magazines that, quite frankly, I look really forward to getting each month. A lot of good folks write for that magazine, a lot of interesting articles and stuff, and you always remember Pete. He had his signature bow tie and made just all the shows. And really delved behind the scenes and was really good at reporting what was going on in the apparatus industry. Pete died comfortably at his home in Vermont on Saturday, September 26th. Among his many, many contributions to the fire and emergency service industry, he served on the FEMSA Board of Directors from 1998 to 2001, and he had a passion for the fire apparatus and equipment industry, and he was kind of a tell-it-like-it-is kind of guy. And Tom and I, we just want to extend our deepest sympathies and condolences to Pete's family and to all of his colleagues that publish Fire Apparatus and Equipment Magazine and their contributors and to the fire service in general. He is going to be really, really missed.
And for our listeners, we'll finish up, as sometimes I say, on somewhat, not necessarily of a lighter note, but for our listeners, to let them know that I, Tom Shand, I've moved on from my really great career in working in the apparatus industry, have left the apparatus industry on a full-time basis with any affiliation with the manufacturer. And we'll be working with Brother Mike moving forward at Emergency Vehicle Response. So really look forward to doing that. It's somewhat of a change of life for me at my stage in life, but I'm looking forward to it. So we're working on continuing not only what we've done, both the writing for the magazine, the instruction, and working real closely with the fine folks at firehouse.com on the podcast. But look forward to developing some other programs that the EDR will be able to offer up in the future. So if people, again, with any listeners have questions that they would like Mike or I, based on our respective either our friendly foe engine versus truck issues or things down to, again, like to thank the folks who wrote in the questions that we answered this month with respect to the outrigger situation on the rear mount, to two-stage pumps, to something as simple as wheel trucks. If you have questions out there, anything that you feel that you can help us, two ways you can get a hold of us, send your questions in to podcast@firehouse.com, and you can always send them in onto Brother Mike's website, emergencyvehiclerespresponse.com, and we'll do the best to get back to you with a hopefully what will be a sage and safe response. And if we don't know, we'll be smart enough to figure it between the two of us. We haven't figured that one out yet. And we look forward to working with the listeners and assisting you to be safe in anything that we can assist you with. So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, we wish everybody going into the fall season here very safe couple of weeks, and look forward to seeing you soon at our next radio podcast. Take care and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.